Welcome back to the Just King Things bonusodes, where we look at media objects that are related to Stephen King. I'm Cameron.
I'm Michael.
Michael, this time we are checking out the 1995 film directed by horror luminary Toby Hooper, The Mangler.
The Mangler.
The Mangler. Had you seen this movie before?
I have, actually. A long, long time ago. I saw this movie when I was a kid, somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's what I remember.
I've never seen this before. I'd only read the story, and I knew it a little bit by reputation. Meaning that anytime Stephen King movie adaptations come up, someone is complaining about The Mangler. They're making fun of it. They're calling it a clown's movie and not in a good way. They're saying it's almost as if 1,000 babies got into a giant overcoat and began to direct a film. They say, oh, it's the scary nightmare man, but he's not in it. You know, these are all quotations from the New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek. I'm reading off the page here. I don't feel that way. I think this movie is pretty good. I think it's pretty interesting. Obviously, we'll get down into the weeds on it, but you watched the movie. I watched it two times in a row. First with a commentary, or no, first without the commentary, obviously. The second time with the commentary, and accompanied, of course, by my very brave wife, who I refer to often on this show, who watches all these movies with me. Unfortunately, this movie prevented me from getting to watch I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robbins in season two at an appropriate time, because I went to turn that on and my wife, who does not particularly care for Tim Robbins, said, no, we're not going to watch that, because I had to sit through The Mangler two times in a row. So it came at great personal cost to me and the timeliness of getting to see I Think You Should Leave season two. And I'm really hurting from it. You know, The Mangler really got me in that way. But I'm not mad that I watched it. I think it's a pretty cool movie. I don't know. Does it hold up from your childhood, Michael? Have you been terrified of industrial laundries for many years?
Well, so I think this has come up on this show before. But the largest employer in my hometown is a casket factory.
Yeah. I think it has come up a few times. I really wanted you to be like, I was once attacked by an industrial laundry.
Well, so what I remember the most, so not only is there a casket factory in my hometown, thing number one, two, many people in my family have worked there throughout the years, and including my father, and also when I was younger, my grandmother, and specifically what she did is she was part of the team that sewed the linings into the caskets. And so the thing that this movie kind of like called back up for me, right, is how when I was young and I saw it, so this is 1995, so I was maybe 7 or 8 when I saw this, was sort of like how struck I was at the time with the way that this film took something that I was very familiar with, which is kind of this like weird space of industrial machinery, because I was like, I would go to visit my dad during lunch hours. Like my mom was working such at the time. She was working like later shifts. So like we would bring my dad lunch. And so we would go through the casket factory and we would go by all of these machines that are running out all of the aluminum and all the metal and stuff that goes into your casket. And we would like go and see my grandmother, who was in the sewing room, which of course is filled with all of these sheets and all of these textiles. And like it felt like the laundry in this film, right? Like that is what sort of came back to me, was watching this as a kid and being like, oh, you could set a horror movie in a place like this, which is like, you know, the quintessential Stephen King thing. And people are like, it's a possessed laundry machine. And it's like, sure. Is that any less weird than a demon possessing a person? Like, why not? Why wouldn't a demon possess a piece of industrial machinery? Let's fucking go.
I love your indignity before the Mangler critic.
I mean,
do I have not a heart?
Well, and I
do
and
I not bleed? the Mangler lover.
It's very interesting to me, right, that I had kind of a very strong response to this film, because Well, I mean, because of that, but also because, you know, watching the film again, it does in some ways feel like a film made for children, despite being filled with lots of gore and some very strange, confusing scenes. There's something about, like, the plot structure and kind of the way that characters are introduced to scenes and the way that they leave them that is, like, very broad and, like, it is legible in kind of a cartoonish way. The movie is just incredibly strange. So, yeah, I you know, DM'd you on Discord like 12 minutes in and I said, I'm only 12 minutes in, but I think the Mangler whips. And by the end, I was like less pleased with it because it sort of, you know, runs out of steam, so to speak. But there's still a lot of really cool stuff here.
Yeah. So I watched the, I think I'm less, about it than you are in that regard, but I was pleasantly surprised and, it really had a lot of things illuminated for me by the commentary with, oh gosh, what is Stephen David Brooks, mm-hmm. who was the writer on the project. Stephen David Brooks, I believe, was a visual effects guy.
I was going to say, not just the writer.
Yeah, and I think was brought on to do visual effects and had done visual effects for a couple major places beforehand. I didn't write it down. But what was pretty well regarded in the VFX world and was brought on to do that kind of stuff, but basically what happened is that Toby Hooper calls him up. And this, I think, explains some of the weirdness of the movie. Toby Hooper calls him up. Toby Hooper is a well-established horror name, kind of on the other end of his career by 1993 when this gets going. And I don't mean on the other end of his career in the sense of like washed up, but, you know, Toby Hooper is super well known for some big important horror films, right? So he's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, of mm-hmm. course, is the director big one. Of that. Yeah, that's the big one. And, but then also Poltergeist, mm-hmm. Which is massive. And there's a lot of controversy over whether Steven Spielberg stealth directed that movie or not. I've listened to some people who were involved in the production who have said, you know, Spielberg was around but did not direct, or Spielberg was around but was not around to direct the film. So who knows, but you know, I'm going to give Toby Hooper credit on that. But by the time that he gets into the early 90s, he's not doing that kind of stuff. You know, I don't think many people think that his greatest work was ahead of him in the 1990s. And he is of course passed at this point now,
mm-hmm.
but, so Stephen David Brooks gets called by Toby Hooper and Toby Hooper says, "Hey, you know about the Mangler?" And, Stephen David Brooks says, "No, I don't really know about the Mangler." And he says, "All right, come over." Gives him the short story that we have talked about on our Night Shift episode. Gives him the short story, and Brooks sits and reads the short story in front of him. And he's like, "Yeah, this is pretty cool." And Toby Hooper says, "Well, do you think you could, like, you know, write a movie around that?" and Stephen David Brooks says, "Yeah, I guess so." And he says, "All right, let me call Stephen King." He calls Stephen King. I don't know if it's based on Brooks' story. I don't know if that's right there in the moment or if it's the next several days or whatever. He calls Stephen King and Stephen King says, "Yeah, okay, sure. Go ahead and do it." And Toby Hooper says, "All right, Stephen David Brooks, we have 10 days to write this script." And they have some conversations. Stephen David Brooks knocks that thing into shape and then they're good to go. They go to South Africa to make the movie. There's all kinds of weird stuff going on with this, right? So part of it has to do with someone already has the rights and there's already been several scripts of the Mangler that have been made by that point. This mm-hmm. is why Harry Allen Towers has a co-script writing credit on this because
I'm sorry that name.
Harry Allen Towers.
Yes. It's like, oh no, look at those Harry Allen Towers.
he's a huge person. Like he wrote a bunch of stuff, did all kinds of important stuff, especially for TV. An English writer. The people who had the rights to it were in dire straits. They weren't able to like make the movie. And so some of the names get reused from his script, but they started with a blank page. And anyway, Hollywood story, things get going. They already have the financing ready to go. They are ready to shoot this movie. They mm-hmm. just don't have a script. And so that's why they do it. Now, you might be wondering, Michael, This is 1993. There's some interesting stuff going on in South Africa at this time.
Yeah.
Basically, apartheid is barely over in South Africa. Mandela has been released from prison, but the free elections have not occurred yet.
Mm-hmm.
But the cultural boycott is now over. You know, everyone's like, okay, it's fine. And Canon Films has been operating there at the time. I think the implication might be that Canon was operating during the boycott. I can't say one way or the other. I don't want to implicate anyone in that. I haven't done the research for it, but there's an implication from Brooks in this commentary that basically the Mangler is coming into production in 93, but other people have already been working there for a minute. So there's some interesting, weird stuff going on there. But yeah, so they shoot this whole thing in South Africa in the moments in the dissolution period after apartheid. And they are, you know, doing the thing. But they wrote it in an extremely small amount of time in its big, broad treatment. They did not have a third act at all. And they basically wrote it on set. This big, effects-heavy movie. The back two-thirds of it was written, or the back third of it was almost entirely produced on set at the time. Is that surprising to you, Michael?
Not at all, because the third act of this movie just like spins out of control in like three different ways.
Yep. I don't even know where to get going here. I mean, do we want to talk about the broad plot?
Sure. Okay. So in a small town called Rikers Falls, Maine, a industrial laundry called Gartley's Blue Ribbon Laundry is a big employer for many people in the town. It is run by a guy named Bill Gartley, played by Robert Englund, who is like eating the scenery, just like devouring it.
Let me tell you. Oh, sorry. I feel like I need to tell you what I know about this before you say anything more about
okay.
it. Robert Englund was signed on to the project before the script was written. Like, Toby Hooper just called him in. Was like, hey, Robert, we're going to South Africa. We're doing the thing. By the way, just looking at this, apartheid legislation in South Africa was repealed in 1991, and the elections that were held under universal suffrage happened in 94. So this is literally filmed before open and free elections in South Africa, which is wild.
Wow.
So Robert Englund is signed on, and when Toby Hooper tells Brooks, is that his last name? I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I can't. Yeah, Brooks. When he is like telling him about how to write the script, you know, when they're coming up with it together, he says, okay, Robert Englund is going to be in this. Robert Englund wants to wear leg braces. He also wants to have one eye. Figure that out. So that was like Robert Englund's character as in the broadest possible strokes was already established before the movie existed.
Wow. Yeah. So yes. He's like the boss of this laundry, which is like presented in it's presented like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory is how it looks, right? Like that's sort of the production design of this entire place. Like it's grimy, steamy, all these women who are like very like sweaty because they're working next to this really hot laundry press, and they also look, you know, pretty worn out and tired, or moving around these giant things of sheets. And then he's up there in like his, you know, solid mahogany office with all of his taxidermied animals up on the walls. And also, it goes without saying that this character is just like there's so much ableist like stuff bound up in this character that the movie runs right into. And we'll talk about that. But he's in leg braces. He's also got crutches he's using, sort of arm crutches. And he has like glasses and then like one like false eye or something. And he's dressed in like this old timey three-piece suit. you know, he's got like a golden watch chain, and he's just like, you know, skittering around, really, is how you would describe him, right? There's a very famous production of Shakespeare's Richard III that Greg Doran did, I think. And Anthony Sher is the actor who played Richard in that. And of course, speaking of characters with a lot of ableist stuff baked into to how they're, you know, perceived and talked about in history. But very famously, this production had Cher playing the Richard III on crutches, and they had him sort of like moving around the stage like a spider. And this is actually holy shit. Anthony Sher's a South African actor. When was that production? Where was that production? How am I just putting this together?
Okay, hold on.
Yes.
Are you intimating that, which direction is this going? Are you thinking Robert England's ripping this off?
Or they're ripping off Robert England.
That's so much more terrifying. That's scarier than this whole movie.
When was that Richard III? Okay, that was 1984. Okay.
Oh my God. He could have seen it.
So yeah, so there's this like one scene kind of down on the ground, and then he's just like up here on these catwalks, right, coming out of his office, just like hollering at them whenever anything goes wrong, talking about how they need to keep going, like they need to work, like the laundry's not going to do itself, we have deadlines to meet, there are margins, and it's all done in this very heightened like expressionist mode. Like it feels like Metropolis, right? I think it is sort of explicitly trying to evoke that sort of thing, like Metropolis or Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or something like that.
Yeah, and also shot, you know, from the bottom looking up. You know, these are never straight on shots, and so it very much is this like he's lording over all these people. Robert England, by the way, was only there for 2 weeks during production, so all of these were shot all at one time, and he was never there for any of the other shots, which of course, right, like that's the magic of movie making, that you can stitch these things together. But it's very funny to me to imagine Robert England just like running around these catwalks screaming as like green lights fly over his face and things like that. One thing I will say stylistically, and I think that this is part of it, is that or part of the reputation of the Wrangler, or the Wrangler, the Wrangler's even better, of the Mangler.
It just does jeans.
It takes everything goes in it, and it comes out jeans. Yes. that's a real Stephen. That's like a Stephen King circa 2007 story, but. I think part of the reputation here and the interviewer who's talking to Brooks in the commentary and kind of prompting him floats this, and I think it makes a lot of sense, that this movie for a long time circulated on VHS, and it circulated on HBO in particular. It was apparently like HBO had the rights for it for a very long time. And the prints that were made, the VHS home copies, apparently are very bad. That's part of the reason that this was recently, by the way, this was recently redone in Blu-ray. I bought that Blu-ray. It is the quote-unquote unrated version that just has a little bit more gore in it. Mm-hmm. It's not, no additional scenes or anything like that. You know, what this interviewer, whose name I didn't write down, I apologize, but what the interviewer kind of floats is that part of the reason for the Mangler having such a bad reputation as a film is that all of the overacting came through in those VHS copies and even some of the prints that came out in theaters, but very little of like the color pop and the stylistic choices that were being made. Mm-hmm. A lot of those were apparently very muddy, to the point where they were muddy even like when they were doing dailies and things like that, to the point where some things in the movie were like rotoscope highlighted and digitally highlighted in post-production to make them pop even more. And so in a Blu-ray, you can really, in kind of the, you know, the HD version of the film that exists now, you can really see crisp color and really strong kind of highlighting using lights and things like that. You can see a lot of subtle detail, I think, especially like when people's fingers are like being ripped off and stuff like that. That's kind of plot important that apparently was very difficult to see in a much darker VHS and then home release versions of that. And so, you know, there's this kind of disconnect between maybe visually what was actually happening versus what people could actually experience of the film, which was just Robert Englund kind of eating all the scenery. Mm-hmm. And so this is a kind of interesting moment where the reception of the film being folded by this interviewer, the reception of the film really being kind of hindered by the way that people experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think the movie is, you know, didn't look good, or that maybe it was all these like hokey performances, maybe worth checking out the HD version. Cause I agree with you. I think it looks awesome. And I think production design, I don't know why I couldn't come up with the word, the production design of like what the sets look like and how they function, I think those are all really, really cool.
Mm-hmm. So we have that, we have the laundry, and there's a great big laundry press in the Blue Ribbon Laundry. It gets possessed by a demon, except it doesn't get possessed by a demon. It turns out it's already possessed by a demon and has been, I guess, forever. This is where things start, like, sort of unraveling very early on, but we don't know that they're unraveling until later, until we realize how little sense any of this makes. There is a woman, a young woman, who is working on the laundry press, which is, like, a fantastic prop. Like, I love how this thing looks. Like, it's got, you know, it's supposed to be this, like, giant cast iron monstrosity or whatever. I guess it's, like, wrought iron, rather, monstrosity. And it's got, like, this pebbled texture that just looks, like, you know, damp. Like, it always looks a little damp. Mm-hmm. And it's always...
It looks like it was hammered together. You know, like, it's got all that those pittings. Toby Hooper's son made that.
Yeah, I wondered, like, I saw that credit, the name in the credits, and I was like, oh, I wonder what relation that is. It's like
Christopher or something like that.
Yeah. And it's got like all of these gears on the side and all these chains, and it looks super. I love it. But a woman is trying to work it, and she cuts her hand and blood gets on like the conveyor belt. And this also happens at the same moment that two movers happen to be moving an old ice box refrigerator with a kind with like the ice kind of like funnel thing on top. And there's like a whole bunch of rotoscoped sparks, that as the thing like hits the mangler or, you know, the laundry press, and oh, what was that? How strange. And this woman's hand is all bloody. Poor her. And then we kind of follow the delivery men off to our protagonist, who is Ted Levine, who is an incredibly strange choice for a leading man.
I think Ted Levine's great in this movie. I think he is legitimately good. I think there is if I could choose anyone from any time, this is a real like specific thing to say, but I really felt this way the whole time watching it. If I were to make a Disco Elysium movie, I would put Ted Levine from this film as Harry Dubois.
Yeah, no, that's the kind of character he is. And Ted Levine, if you folks don't know, he's kind of he's a very familiar character actor. He's probably a person that you've seen, even if you don't know you've seen him. His most famous role is probably that of Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
You know, that's a very distasteful movie for various reasons. So bracketing that for a second, if you can remember, like, just the presence that guy has, and when he shows up in other films, he's always kind of like a malevolent character. He's kind of typecast in that way. He's usually a villain. He's a big dude, or like, I don't know if he is. I don't know how tall
he
is.
He's not a big dude. Oh. They actually talk about this in the commentary. He's apparently a really lithe and kind of small man, and he carries himself like a big dude.
I was going to say, even on screen.
He walks with his shoulders out, you know?
And yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
On screen, he has, like, this presence of sort of, like, size in a way that's really intimidating. And he has a sort of very strong Midwestern, sort of, like, northern Wisconsin, Minnesota region accent. And not in kind of, like, the cutesy Fargo way of, like, oh, yeah, you betcha. But more like the, oh, God. Like, or I'm trying to think.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's as if his whole like torso is hollow in some ways, right? So he's always talking like this.
Yeah. Right. There.
And he has some amazing lines in this movie, by the way.
Numbnuts. Jesus.
He calls someone like a dog fuck.
Uh huh.
Hold on. I think I wrote it in here. Yeah.
I
piece of dog fuck.
Yeah.
And that, which was apparently a real thing that was used in I can't believe I keep forgetting his name. Brooks, Stephen David Brooks. Uh-huh. That was apparently something they would say in his like production house all the time. They would call something that didn't work a piece of dog fuck and a PDF. And so that's why that's in the movie. It's in the movie two times, by the way.
Oh, but, I only noticed once. So I
know it shows up twice. Yeah, he one's like an ADR line for some reason.
There's a lot of weird ADR in this film.
Yes, because all the actors are South African and they cannot do an American accent.
There's a couple like, of lines that I'm pretty sure like that are ADR'd in for Robert Englund, and I don't think it's Robert Englund doing them.
Oh, that's amazing. I didn't catch that. But yeah, anyway, Ted Levine is just doing this kind of like he is the antithesis of a hero in a movie.
I was gonna say he's Harry Dubois. He is a cop with a troubled past, and he's kind of like fallen to pieces. He's a little bit of a noirish character, which is made all the more hysterical, right? Because he's just there. He wants to at this point, he just wants to do his job, get his retirement and get his pension. He talks about this as if he's like in a Lethal Weapon movie, but he's in, and I said the name of the town incorrectly earlier. It's Rikers Valley, Maine, which is presented as a small town that is also called the industrial heart of New England. But he is simultaneously a big city, like cynical cop who is working in this idyllic, picturesque Maine village. and this is never really, this is never squared, right? Like two kind of separate versions of reality that the character inhabits just like coexist in this really bizarre way.
And what's it? So two things are amazing here. One is that he's like, as you said, like, it's like a Lethal Weapon. He's shooting for his pension. He's getting too old for this shit, except he's a man in his 40s and he's only like 12 years into a 20 year thing. He has like a lot of time to go, which is really, really funny. The other thing about that is Ted Levine is method.
Oh,
And so he and no one else on set is method for this movie. Robert Englund is like the definition of not a method actor.
Yes.
And so he's like eating all this scenery and like being arch and all this kind of stuff. And Ted Levine is like fighting machines and like can't calm down after the take is over. He like has to, you know, be like taken outside and like kind of worked over a little bit, you know, like, are you okay? Given some water, that kind of stuff. And so you're seeing Ted Levine like go as hard as possible for a role that in it, at its heart, as you're saying, from a genre perspective, from a literal perspective, purely informationally, does not make any sense. And yet it works, I think, because he has a parallel character, a partner character, who is a hippie.
Who's his brother-in-law?
His brother-in-law for his wife, who he accidentally murdered.
Yeah. So that's his other, that's a secret kind of like, you know, shame is that he accidentally caused a car accident that resulted in the death of his wife. And now the only person in the world he has is his brother-in-law, who is a hippie demonologist who lives next door to him in like this weird hippie, like nature preserve enclave kind of thing.
Yeah, there's like bottles and Christmas or like lights and stuff.
All these like
very future forward.
Yeah, like little windmills and things, like lawn ornaments. In his house, he's got like all of these various, you know, like ceremonial masks from different cultures.
And Ted Levine is, you know, a few times is like, I just can't believe I killed my wife. And his brother-in-law, and it's his sister, and in any American film, you know, that's like a prestige drama or even horror at this point now, right? It would be like, yeah, you know, you did kill my sister and I don't like you anymore, but we're going to have to get together to get rid of this cursed laundry machine. You know, it would be the kind of thing where the call to action would bring them together, you know, in the parlance of whatever, that kind of thing. But here it's like, yeah, we're best friends and you killed my sister, but like, I've forgiven you for that and you need to get over it because we're hanging out. Like, I cook you dinner now. And that's how things are. It's in some ways, it's like, this is the kind of this is what I really like about it, right? Because on one hand, it's like that goes against every filmmaking instinct on the planet. And that's why we would make fun of the Mangler, because of everything I just said. On the other hand, this is the picture of a good relationship of people who've been through trauma and are trying to live their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that a lot.
Yeah, and like the other thing that is like fantastically weird about this is like it when you first see these characters together. So we've actually jumped forward quite a bit into the film, because what happens is like they are delivering this refrigerator, and just by coincidence, they almost like have an auto accident with Ted Levine, and they're just like, oh, we're just trying to deliver this refrigerator for whatever reason. To like his neighbor, and he yells mm-hmm. at them a lot, and this is how we find out he's a cop, because he's threatening to arrest them.
Mm-hmm.
And then some other,
they're like, get out of the way, dumbass. He's like, that's Officer Dumbass to you.
Yeah,
I love that. I love an Officer Dumbass.
And then so that happens, and then we get our first death scene at the laundry, and we can maybe talk about that. But then later on, he is suddenly hanging out with this guy whom we've never seen before, and there's like a palpable intimacy between these characters. And as you've already pointed out, Cameron, like the other guy is making him dinner, and this is like a regular occurrence that they're like going over to each other's houses for dinner. And like the other guy, the brother-in-law, is very clearly like kind of a caretaker in this way. Mm-hmm. And there's like a sort of, you know, anomalous homoeroticism about the whole thing, especially considering that, like, they're, you know, they have their sort of little spats, but then, you know, the, I think is, what's his brother-in-law's name? It's like Mike or something.
I have no idea what anyone's name is. Like in everything else we watch and read.
Anyway, yeah. So the brother-in-law kind of like, pulls him back around, and you know they have a little spat. Then the brother-in-law kind of makes nice with him, and then they're getting along and cracking jokes, and you know they just really enjoy each other's company, and they're kind of like walking off into, you know, the distance. And then there's a line that's 80 yard in where Ted Levine he says something like, "I sure am glad you're my brother-in-law." And that happens a couple of times where at the end of a scene, they like ADR in a line that mentions that he is a brother-in-law, because it was clear, I think, from like watching it that otherwise it looks like they have some other type of relationship.
I don't know. I do think it's deeply unclear just what their relationship is, period.
Well, and that's the other thing, is that they are kind of, there's this other thing that's happening here where in the laundry, everything is going full expressionist. At Ted Levine's house and with his brother-in-law, we're almost getting Beckettian, where these characters are like two halves of one person, because Ted Levine is like the rationalist who, you know, the cynical rationalist who's just like, oh, it's a bunch of bullshit. You know, none of this stuff you believe in is real, blah, 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 blah. And the brother-in-law is like, don't you believe in higher powers? Don't you believe in supernatural things? And it's about sort of like this, we get like this tension between them, that it's there. It doesn't exactly work in the film. And when I say tension, like, right, I mean like, you know, they overcome their differences, right? They learn to work together. But continue, Cameron.
Yeah, the only thing I was just gonna follow up with that by saying that, yeah, there's this weird thing where his you know, I think Mark is his name. Yeah. I think, and his whole thing is like, well, what if a demon is just energy?
Yeah.
and also there's the fact that he clearly is a South African guy, right?
Yeah.
But he's trying to do an American accent, and no one can do an accent in this movie. To the point where there's a man at the very end of the film who is like a postman who walks up and hands Ted Levine a letter. He's just what do you call it? A South African guy. He's like, hey there.
Yeah.
And it's like, why'd you go through all of this effort to disguise, quote unquote, everyone's accent and just like leave one guy in? Seems easy to do, but yeah, but Mark is constantly like, what if it is just energy? demons and devils and angels are energy.
A lot of very strong, like, Dark Place vibes here.
Oh yeah, a lot, but like, but not sold as a joke, and I think like works really well if you're just willing to kind of give into the structure of the thing, you know, that a lot of this is stylized, and is, you know, like, Ted Levine is not stumbling into this character because he is inexperienced or doesn't know what he's doing. He is playing this character as this kind of like hardcore rationalist, like, beat up man. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Daniel Matmore is the guy's name, is playing his brother-in-law, Mark, as a, you know, he says that he's like a theoretical metaphysician or something. Yeah. But, you know, like, it's played straight up. It's not played for a laugh. And maybe this is the best place to put this. In, this is the wildest thing to say about this movie. So, the writer,
mm-hmm.
whose name I'm yet again blanking on, Stephen David Brooks. Stephen David Brooks says that part of the legacy of this, the problem of the legacy of this movie, is that people don't understand if it's meant to have humor in it or not. You know, so people think it's meant to be straight up, and then you get this overacting, for example, from Robert Englund, and you think, oh, this is just badly done.
Mm-hmm.
So he believes that this would have been solved if they'd kept a certain scene in.
Uh-huh.
So the second, this actually kind of is appropriate for moving us along. So, you know, we saw Sherry, the young girl, get her hand cut mm-hmm. earlier in the film. There's the whole thing with the refrigerator, the icebox. The first person to get murdered by it straight up is an older woman who gets eaten by the machine and then like kind of pressed and crushed and thrown through it, mm-hmm. you know, to the other end. She has a watch on. And it's clearly visible in early scenes with her.
Mm-hmm.
There was meant to be a joke, a Timex joke. You know, Timex takes a licking and keeps on ticking.
Mm-hmm.
You're familiar with yes. the catchphrase, mm-hmm. the commercial. There was meant to be a joke in the film that after she is crushed and mangled, by this machine, that there would be an insert shot of her watch. And it would be crushed and destroyed, but still working. Solidifying, obviously, this is a joke. Ha ha ha, and Timex would be on it. Ha ha ha, it's a Timex watch, takes a lick and keeps on ticking. And Stephen David Brooks says that when that was in the original audience test screens, everyone laughed, and then everyone laughed through the rest of the movie at the like laugh lines.
Because mm-hmm.
they knew that there was obviously jokes in it. When they took that insert shot out of the payoff, the punchline for the joke, people didn't know if it was funny or not for the rest of the movie. And so that has marred the legacy of the mangler, removing the Timex joke from the film.
I mean, on the one hand, that might be, you know, placing a lot of straw on a camel's back, I guess. But the other thought I have is maybe there's something to that, because that that scene where that woman gets pulled into the machine, it is gruesome. And if a joke came at the end of that, I would have a better sense of what this movie knew it was doing, rather than being like, okay, so how does this movie want me to respond to the individual bits of it? But if it followed its first big kill with a joke, I would probably have a better idea of what it wanted to do.
Yeah, I don't know one way or the other. I think it's an interesting theory that I guess is theoretically provable. Like mm-hmm. you could theoretically test that out. But yeah, that's his thing. He thinks that the legacy would be much stronger. And it's very Toby Hooper-ish. You know, Toby Hooper mm-hmm. is despite making the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, he's a funny film director.
Yeah, I mean the sequel to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a comedy.
Yes, and the poster for it was famously The Breakfast Club.
Yeah.
With all the people from the family members from TCM. So I don't know one way or the other, but that's the way he kind of thinks that. Also very Toby Hooper is that you just get to watch Ted Levine vomit on screen.
Uh-huh.
Apparently that's him really vomiting.
No method.
Yeah, he was like, they were like, oh, here's some stuff to do. He's like, no, just give me a vanilla milkshake.
Okay.
Apparently, if he has a vanilla milkshake, Ted Levine can throw up. So that's really him doing it. Yeah, so she's kind of the kindly old woman, and this is the first true victim of the thing. I don't remember exactly what happens next. What's next in the plot line of the film?
Okay, so the other thing that happens is that after the woman gets pulled through the mangler, we are introduced to another character from, like, this film's third plot. There are three different versions of this movie that you can glimpse at the end, and I'll try to sort of, like, pull them apart and describe them once we get there. But here, after this woman is killed, we meet the, like, crime, the local crime scene photographer.
Holy
you
shit,
know that every small town in Maine has.
Yeah.
Who walks around in, like, a fedora and a trench coat with his giant, like, news guy camera.
Talking like this.
Yeah. And he's also, like, clearly a younger actor wearing an incredible amount of, like, makeup to make him look old. Which Robert Englund is also in a bunch of pieces as well, too, which also feels very Toby Hooper-y, right? It made me think of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where they meet the grandfather, who is played by a young man wearing, like, an old man costume.
Oh, God, yeah, that grandfather in Texas Chainsaw Massacre in that first film, that hammer scene.
Mm-hmm.
Burned into my head. Toby Hooper has a... And that's also a scene that is... Both plays as comedy and, like, deeply terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Because the joke is that, like, you know, he's an old decrepit man and he can't kill someone with a hammer the way he used to be able to. Whew. Sorry to derail us, but that movie is...
yeah. Well, back in the Mangler land, this photographer says some, like, portentous or ominous things to the cop, whose name is John. And it's clear that they have, like, some sort of friendship that has fallen into disrepair for some vague reason, because I guess, you know, Levine is just, you know, being self-destructive or something, except he's doing really well with his brother-in-law, so...
Yeah, I think the implication, this wasn't talked about in the commentary at all, but the only thing I can piece together is that I think that he was drinking... with this guy. I don't want to say his name yet. With the photographer.
Uh-huh.
I think he was drinking with the photographer the night that his wife died.
Mm. Okay. That makes sense.
I believe because, yeah, they have that conversation later where he's like, oh, you know, we can go and work on that bottle of, I think it's like Irish whiskey or
That's
something.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
That we started 3 years ago. That just seems really specific. So I think that's meant to be like part of the plotty part of it there is that he associates his wife dying with the photographer.
Yeah, and so the photographer says all this stuff, and then John Levine is just like, you know, he's like, bruh, 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 I don't, whatever, you weirdo. He's like, go away, you picture man.
Yep.
Do we want to let it out now?
Oh. Yes, because I also have some additional information about this that's very funny.
Okay.
But yeah, do the revelation about the photographer man.
So, the Levine's character just calls him picture man, you know, kind of in this disparaging tone. And you're just like, yeah, you know, that's what this type of cop would call, you know, the crime scene photographer who's always showing up. And it's... You know, throughout the rest of the film, this character keeps showing up. He's never really addressed by name, but I think at a couple points, he's always called, like, Picture Man. And then at the end of the film, after he dies, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So after he dies...
He dies unrelated to the Mangler, by the way.
Yeah, no,
he just happens to die.
Incidentally. And that's like that again, that's like there's another movie in this movie that is like about the relationship between this cop and this photographer. That's just sort of happening. So he dies unrelatedly, at which point we come to learn the character's literal name is Picture Man. His name is JJJ Picture Man. And he is a crime scene photographer, when you had this realization, you told me on Discord, you were like, friends at the table ass name, which, yes, right? I am in awe that they have this character who is performed like this, presented like this, and is named JJJ Picture Man.
So the actor who plays JJJ Picture Man is named Jeremy Crutchley, who apparently came, I think Picture Man is in the script. I don't know how, and that has to be, yeah, just name it Picture Man and we'll name him a real name later. And they just never changed it. There's no way that that was anything other than that. That was unremarked upon in the commentary. But what was filled in the commentary is that Brooks says that Jeremy Crutchley is the person who was like, why not make his name JJJ? Wouldn't that be cool? And Toby Hooper was like, yeah, that's good. And it's, and I, you know, this is what really makes you feel like directors are human beings, because you know that Toby Hooper was like, that would be funny as shit for it to be JJJ Picture Man. And maybe this also will fill in some information about Toby Hooper, because, you know, he likes gore. He likes funny stuff in horror. His two favorite things to do were to smoke cigars and drink Dr. Pepper. And they had to import, they couldn't get Dr. Pepper in South Africa, so they had to import a bunch of like UK equivalent, like gallons and gallons and gallons of some sort of UK equivalent to Dr. Pepper while making this movie so he could drink it. So like that's what's going on. Toby Hooper is sitting there helping brainstorm a script in less than 2 weeks, powering down fake Dr. Pepper and cigars and laughing about JJJ Picture Man.
I wonder what the British equivalent of Dr. Pepper is.
Oh, it might be Lucozade. It's Lucozade.
Oh, I was hoping it was going to be something like, I don't know, Barrister Pop Crackle.
No, I don't think so. I think it was like a form of Lucozade. Brooks said, you know, it was the closest they could get to Dr. Pepper, but I think it's kind of like Gatorade, so I don't know.
Okay.
One way or the other. But that's like, when Brooks is talking about these things in the commentary, all these things are happening at one time in his mind. Like, Toby Hooper is making all these decisions all in one whack. JJJ Picture Man, it just killed me. God, I laughed so hard at that. Also, the letters that he reads at the end, Jeremy Crutchley wrote those letters. They're not in the script.
Oh, my God.
And he just said, hey, have Ted Levine read these, and then just, like, you can dub it over at the end of the movie. And that's what they did. So they're in character, written by the actor playing JJJ Picture Man.
So the other thing about the actor playing JJJ Picture Man, did this come up in the commentary, that he's another character?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
He plays the mortician who is also the town undertaker who's also the coroner who like works in the like police station where also JJJ Pictureman has his offices on a different floor. So Ted Levine goes in to see because he at a later point in the film, this is like nearing the end of the whole thing. He has to go look at some corpses, and the undertaker slash mortician slash coroner is just like this really weird looking. He looks a lot actually like the character from Kingdom Hospital who plays the security guard.
He looks like half that guy and half Marty McFly's dad.
Yeah, like Crispin Glover
kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah.
And he's very weird, like, and he's not wearing his old age makeup at this point, right? He looks very, very different. But he's, of course, the joke is obvious. He's the unnervingly cheerful undertaker who wants to tell you all about the, like, little cool things that he did to recompose the body of this woman who got run through the mangler. And then he offers Levine a cherry tomato.
Yeah, what a specific and odd thing to do. He's like, you want a cherry tomato? He's also doing another voice there, too. He's like, you want a cherry tomato? I laughed about cherry tomato, too. And the joke here, there's a joke, quote-unquote, as Brooke says, because he leaves the scene, and then JJJ Pictureman comes in. So it's the same actor leaving the scene and then coming back in. And again, you know, my as I referred to earlier, my very brave wife watches these commentaries with me, and you would not believe the eye rolling that on display when Brooks revealed that. she was so over the shit at that point. Because it is not surprising or interesting in any way once you realize they're the same guy. It does not feel like a joke. It just feels like, oh, that's the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But, anyway, but to wheel it all the way back, Ted Levine has to fight that refrigerator.
Yeah, so like he tracks down the guys who are delivering it. The refrigerator falls on him. And that's when he says the line that I quoted earlier, "Numbnuts, Jesus." And then they like pull the fridge off of him, and he gets called into the scene of the first killing, the woman who got pulled into the mangler. And then this refrigerator plot line is so confusing. It's from the original story, but it shows up as just like the demonologist character in that story, who I think is also still the protagonist's brother-in-law, but the wife isn't dead. He mentions something like, also, this is the other thing, is that he's not a demonologist. He's like a college professor who just happens to know some things about demonology and then looks into it more. But he mentions that he like found a story about an old icebox that seemed to keep killing people, like animals and children. And he presents this as sort of evidence for his thesis that machines or objects can become possessed by evil spirits just as much as people can. And here, instead, we've got this refrigerator that, like, sparks on the mangler, gets delivered to Ted Levine's neighbor. Later on in the film, he's driving by the neighbor's house, and the neighbor's, like, standing out in the road, like, calling for something. And it turns out she's calling for her kid, but I didn't notice that she had a kid in the earlier scene, if that was even established.
And she's not in the earlier scene at all.
That's what
they're
I thought.
Delivering it to an empty house, yeah.
That's what I thought was, like, so weird, is that we don't even know that there's a kid here. We just have this woman, like, standing in the road, like, shouting a name.
Well, here's the wilder part about it. When what happens in just a minute, she says, "I don't even know where this refrigerator came from."
Yeah, yeah.
So why was it being delivered to her home?
So it turns out she's looking for her daughter. And I think Levine shows up later because he notices the sirens at her house or something, because emergency crews have showed up because the girl crawled into the refrigerator and the door closed and she suffocated, which is a thing that, you know, rather infamously has happened, can actually happen, like children playing in dumps get trapped in old refrigerators and things like that, which is why you're supposed to take off the doors before you get rid of those things. Anyhow, as you say, this girl has, you know, crawled into the mangler icebox. She's died. And the mom is like, "I don't even know where this came from or why it's here." So, and we never learn. Why is it here?
Why? The mangler sent it. The mangler did it.
The mangler.
Yes, it made a work order delivering a refrigerator. But so here's the thing. This is the interesting thing. We know, you know, sparks happened, all that stuff we saw earlier. Did the mangler infect the refrigerator, do you think?
That appears to be the case, right? Because as I said in the earlier, in the story, this is unrelated and it's like evidence for the other thesis. But here the mangler, well, and that's, I guess, the other thing is that I think there's maybe a version of this story where the demon jumps from the icebox into the mangler. But as we've already alluded to, we find out that the mangler is possessed from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So I guess it infected the fridge, and now the fridge is, I don't know, going to go off and be a mangler fridge. Except it doesn't, because Ted Levine kills it.
Ted Levine kills it. It's amazing. So Ted Levine is like, you know, because he's seen some bad stuff, right? He saw this awful crushing from the mangler, and he's, you know, his wife's dead, which we know from the film has told us pretty bad. He's got a lot of just bad stuff going on. So he goes and gets a hammer and just knocks the shit out of this thing. But the reason he does this, by the way, is it tries to kill his brother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
They open it up and there's a dove in there with a bunch of dead birds, and they let that dove out, and then the refrigerator closes on Mark's arm, trying to eat him.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ted Levine's not going to have that, and he goes and gets a hammer and just starts beating the hell out of it.
Well, what I love about that scene, right, is what he says. He says to the woman whose house it is, his neighbor or whatever, he's like, "Do you have a hammer?" And she's like, "Yeah, in the garage," or whatever. And so he walks off into the garage. He like walks off the screen. And, you know, he asked, "Do you have a hammer?" And I think, you know, claw hammer. But no, he comes walking back in with a sledgehammer.
A full two-handed, like pole driving hammer for like rebar. And just goes to town on that thing. Just starts wailing on it. And like, this is going to, I never thought I would say this. And this is going to sound really goofy coming out of my mouth. But Ted Levine does an amazing job killing that refrigerator. It legitimately feels as if there's emotion, and it's like a man who doesn't believe what he's seeing. He doesn't believe in demons and devils and whatnot, but it tried to kill his brother-in-law, and he's gonna take it out, and he beats it up and knocks its head off, and then energy explodes into the universe from it.
Yeah, a demon tornado shoots out into the sky.
CGI effects, by the way.
Oh.
Some very early CGI, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Not rotoscoped. I thought it was rotoscoped.
I thought
and,
so too.
Brooks was very quick. The guy questioned him, was like, "Oh, interesting rotoscope." And he goes, the guy interviewing him says, "Well, it's interesting what they did before digital effects." And Stephen David Brooks says, "No, that's digital." not the only digital effect in the film, by the way. So now Ted Levine kind of believes in curses and demons and devils and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh gosh, some more stuff goes on with Robert Englund. I think we could probably shortcut a little bit here. He gets a teenager,
I guess.
He recruits a teenager to be part of his evil crew.
I don't, the ages in this movie also get very confusing. So it's this.
Sherry is 16 years old.
Yes, she is 16 years old, but does not go to school and, works in the laundry, and also lives with him because she's his niece, and he keeps a very controlled sort of like rein, like a leash on her. But then also there's this other woman who's working at the laundry, Lin Su, who he pulls up from the floor basically, and he's like, "You're gonna be my assistant." And then this is the other thing that this performance reminds me of. He goes a little bit, you know, Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet.
Yes,
yeah,
100%.
Yeah, where he like basically, right, he lets this woman in to his office, and he's like, "You know, you're gonna kind of be my assistant or whatever now." And then he makes her go to the full bathroom that he has off of his office and has her bathe while he watches, and he's like, "You know, do it for Uncle Bill," or whatever he calls himself. So there's like this weird thing where he has implied feelings for his niece that he's like redirecting onto this woman, who then he also like lets know that the laundry press is possessed by a demon and has been forever, and every person in the town, like every powerful person in the town, has made a deal with the demon to like you know, for success and wealth, and for some reason he wants her to be a part of this.
Yeah, there's some weird like machinery going on here, like plot machinery. Yeah, he's like a sex creep. He's bad, you know. You know, in horror movie mode, right, she becomes turncoat, essentially, right?
Yeah.
She, like, seizes power here, and that, like, allows him to know, oh, she's going to be evil like everyone else. But, yeah, basically everyone in this town who has any, even, like, modicum of power has given their, like, their right ring finger to the machine, and it, like, doesn't come out the other end. It, like, eats it.
Mm-hmm.
And they are conferred some amount of power. So it's like the judge and the mayor and the head of the laundry and some probably other, the sheriff, I think, all these other people. And now her, right? And we know she becomes evil because she gets like a big floofy hairdo.
Yes, right. She like gets her evil perm. It was the 90s.
Yeah, exactly. And so there kind of becomes this thing of like, and we know, we find out, J.J. Picturman dies, And Ted Levine, he tells Ted Levine as he's like on his deathbed, he says, I've got a present for you down there. Go to my office and check out the present. And so he goes down there and he finds, hey, JJJ Pictureman is an old guy in this town. He's been taking pictures of all kinds of shit for a billion years. And wouldn't you know it, every single person also who has power here, they're not just missing their finger. They've lost a child at the age of 16.
And all of them were lost in the laundry, in the mangler.
Yeah. And so, lo and behold, you know, it's this kind of sacrificial thing, right? So the town, like you were saying, is the industrial core of rural Maine on due to mass sacrifice, essentially, from all these people. And Robert Englund has brought this kind of turncoat woman in, and there's this kind of subplot going on with his assistant, the floor manager, who kind of figures all this out too, mm-hmm. at the same time, and decides to go back on it. Ted Levine shows up with his buddy at this point, and there's like a really cool scene where this floor manager guy gets his arm stuck in the mangler, and he's like, you know, it's not like a sacrifice moment. He's just legitimately stuck, and a guy's got to like chop his arm off with a fire axe. Mm-hmm. And it's like this reverse shot where he's like gonna do it, and it like, you know, we cut to the guy who's like being crushed, and it's like awful. And he's like, do it, and the guy's like, I can't do it, and it's just drawn out for a very long amount of time.
Yeah, normally the mangler, when it gets someone, it's just like om, nom 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 nom, but with this guy, it just like gets his hand, and it's like I'm gonna like, you know, ruminate on this for a while.
Yes. And yeah, this other guy just can't do it. So, but he does eventually, and it's cool. Look, it's a pretty good effect. Blood everywhere. A lot of blood. Apparently, Toby Hooper actually is the person who was spraying people with blood in this movie because he didn't think there was enough of it. And so there's apparently like production stills of this movie where he is like shooting people with a blood cannon in order to like get the quote unquote right amount of blood. And there's blood everywhere on everyone. Mm-hmm. It's great. Ted Levine also shows up at some point here. I'm getting my, like, even though I watched this movie twice, it's hard to have everything in order. At some point he goes in this place in order to confront Robert Englund. And he gets caught. His coat, yes. Which he's been wearing the whole movie.
Oh my God, this
is
amazing.
This is my favorite scene in the movie. Favorite scene in the movie, no question. He's sitting there. The mangler gets his coat, which he's been wearing the whole time. And I, like, my wife and I began laughing so hard when this started because it became clear that the reason he's been wearing this detective's overcoat, this like film noir overcoat, the whole movie is just so it could get caught in the mangler.
Yeah.
It's Chekhov's coat.
Yeah.
It's caught in the... No, go ahead.
And then it meets Chekhov's police gun. Because to free himself from the mangler, he pulls out his gun and starts, well, first he tries to shoot the mangler. He's like firing just bullets into it. Nothing happens. So then he shoots through his own coat. He's like trying to like line up the shots to like tear his coat away.
Yeah, like he's shooting, and it's like this insert shot of just like someone going ham with this gun, just shooting a coat that's caught in like a feeding thing, and very effective. I was like, oh my God, that's a very smart thing to do. But there's this amazing close up. He drops the gun. He gets himself free, but drops the gun, and it goes into the mangler.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife immediately said, oh my God, the mangler's got a gun now. And it never goes anywhere.
No. I was kind of hoping that would happen, too.
Oh, me too. Well, because at the end of the movie, the mangler, spoilers for something we'll talk about in a minute. At the end of the movie, the mangler has hands.
Yeah.
And it should have pulled a gun. Like, it should have had a gun and been able to fire it. But
that's when the gun should have come back, is like the gun disappeared. And then later when the, like, the hands come out, then Ted Levine would have been like, oh, crap, my gun.
Yeah, and it reaches inside of its body, it pulls it out and starts firing at him. But Harry Dubois again, you know, this is Disco Elysium up and down. But yeah, he does that anyway. He gets, you know, run out of the mangler zone, and, you know, believes in the mangler even more. And the end of the movie happens.
Yeah. Actually, just
there's some like more conversations and stuff. But
yeah, I was gonna say I just want to back up and cover just a few things.
Please do.
For relevance. One is that there is a line where I don't know who says this. I didn't write it down. But regarding the the conspiracy among the town elders or whatever. Someone, I think it might be the brother-in-law, is like, you know, haven't you ever wondered why Riker's Valley is so weirdly perfect? And I wrote in my notes, no, I haven't, because I have never seen the town. I have only seen the laundry, the neighbor's house, Ted Levine's house, and the hospital. You never see the town once in this entire film, but apparently it's weirdly perfect.
Well, come on now. There's a matte painting that allows you to see like one steeple in the far distance of the idyllic town.
Yeah.
That partially comes from, so this is filmed in Johannesburg, and in Johannesburg, every home, many homes in the, basically the white part of the city is the implication here, but all the homes are surrounded by walls. And so there was nothing that could look like Maine. And basically, they had to, like, search around for, like, a micro suburb to find even two houses that were, like, connected in the way that the two houses in the film are. And so in that way, the architecture, like, what you're feeling here, this gap, is really feeling the architecture of Johannesburg in the movie, even though it's never present, is that it can't stand in for the United States because apartheid itself is so materially present in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It really adds a whole other dimension to the film.
Wow. So there's that. I want to touch on that. The other thing is that Mark at some point, you know, drawing again from the short story, he's like, well, you know, a demon could have gotten into the Mangler by accident if all of the right things for a summoning ritual came together just by happenstance. Maybe the woman who cut her hand on it, you know, was she a virgin? And Ted Levine is like, you know, how am I supposed to know that? And Mark is like, well, let's ask her. So they do. They hop in the car and they drive off to the spooky mansion where Robert Englund is keeping Sherry. And she is there. She like shows them. She has like a shelf of all these baby dolls. She's very young acting. And of course, as I said, it's implied that he's been keeping a very tight leash on her, very sheltered, because her entire sort of existence is building up to her being sacrificed to the Mangler. Spoilers. But they just show up and they just ask her this point blank. And of course, she's quite offended. And also, at this point, they don't know she's 16. They don't figure that out until later. This is before the scene where they get all of the stuff from Pictureman that lets them know about, like, the 16-year-old sacrifices. So it's a weird scene that then gets more context that makes it even weirder. And then Sherry kind of becomes a protagonist for a little bit, and this is another film that's in here. Like, there is a version of this movie that is about Sherry and kind of her life underneath like Gartley's thumb and having to work in the laundry and, you know, discovering the terrible thing that awaits her, because like she is kind of I think what happens is, you know, Gartley gives her birthday cake or something and then is going to sacrifice her to the Mangler, but do you remember this? Like, everything is discordant and out of joint at this point, but there's like a scene where she's, you know, standing in the shower crying and like washing the blood off of her because the Mangler has taken her finger.
Is that, I don't think that's when it takes her finger.
Oh, okay.
It's toward the end of the movie. Maybe it is after it's taken her finger. Anyway, well, what ends up happening? Everyone ends up in the place,
mm-hmm.
right? They all end up in the laundry. It's wild to me that I can watch this movie literally twice in a row 2 days ago, and I like can't put the chronology together. Something really weird going on with that. But they all end up there, and Mark says, like, look, as long as this thing is like a little bitty baby demon, we can kill it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's got Belladonna in it, that's going to be a problem. So they all go there. They end up feeding Robert Englund to it. And we get this, like, brutal scene where he's like fed through the machine and then he gets folded at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like extremely graphic. And in the unrated version, it's very graphic. But you know, a real little thing. There's apparently a Toby Hooperism like joke in there where the press happens and then it unfolds and then presses again and like double pushes, which is pretty funny. But yeah, it's super gross. And they're like, okay, well that he's out of the picture, but we still have a cursed mangler. And then they start like doing the Lord's Prayer at it and doing all kinds of stuff and throwing things at it. And Ted Levine is whipping shit at this thing. Like, he is throwing crosses and Bibles at it, and like he's throwing things really hard. Anyway, so like whip some stuff in there, and it starts blowing up, and then it like, you know, goes quiet. And they're like, finally, we've done it. Yeehaw.
Mm-hmm.
Little do they know that, and little do we know, earlier in the film, Ted Levine, his stomach is upset. Because murders.
Mm-hmm.
He has begun taking Tums, essentially, from the dead body, or for the leftovers from the older woman who was killed at the beginning of the film.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of the movie, when he's going through her effects, he actually finds more and replaces the bottle from her personal effects. So he's been pounding these Tums down the whole time. Much like in the short story, Mark, his brother-in-law, finds out, hey, hold on a minute. And he's like looking at the label because he wants some of these Tums. He's like knockoff Tums. And he says, oh my gosh, this has got belladonna in it. And then the machine comes back to life. It starts like blowing up and shit. And it grows arms and legs and starts chasing them everywhere.
Yes, because it turns out, one, some of these pills fell onto the machine's conveyor belt. In fact, that's how it got the kindly old woman at the beginning, is that she was trying to grab some of them and then it pulled her in. So it's eaten the Tums. And Mark tells us that demons summoned or that have eaten belladonna or something are like the most dangerous kind. And so that's when he's like, oh no, there's belladonna in these Tums. And then the mangler like starts just blowing up.
And again, like this sounds silly, but this is also just the plot of the short story. It's like not that different. So it starts exploding and it grows like arms and legs and starts chasing them everywhere. And this is all CG and it looks pretty good. Like for 1995, like pretty cool looking little machine chasing them around.
It's got big red eyes with like snake slit pupils.
And like a big like feeder mouth, like the bar, like safety bar, is like chomping up and down, and we see it kind of from an angle a lot of the time, so you know they don't show too much of the monster, which is a good idea, I think. But Mark falls down and gets rent in twain, unfortunately, and that's also a pretty gruesome effect. There's some sort of crypt, kind of like the end of the first Baldur's Gate game, where all the souls of Baal are kept.
It reminded me of actually another story from Night Shift, Graveyard Shift, where he's below the mill, and then he keeps, like, he goes into the sub-basement, and then the sub-sub-basement, and he keeps, like, going lower and finding, and eventually he finds something that appears to be, like, almost like a cathedral or whatever.
Because
that's what this is like, is they're running from the mangler. And they're in the basement, and then they just, it's, you know, it's friggin' Minas Morgul is what it is. Like this eerie green, white, glowing spiral staircase with arches that descends down sort of interminably. But don't worry, they get to the bottom, they jump down and fall through, and it turns out there's just a sewer down there.
Well, so before this, yes, that happens. Before that, Sherry basically says, I would rather be dead than have to keep running. And so in a fit of pique, runs back and shoves her hand in the monster's mouth.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
So that's how she loses the finger.
Exactly. So that's how she loses the finger. And then they go jump in the thing. And yeah, they're just in the sewer. And then they get out and they're okay. And, you know, there's like some unfortunateness. All leading to the end of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Last scene of the film. well, where Ted Levine is no longer wearing his cop outfit.
He got fired for investigating the truth of the laundry earlier on.
He dug too deep. And so he goes back in there. The mangler is back in place. What is happening? Oh, my gosh. And then he looks up, and Robert Englund, of course, dead, no longer there. But Sherry is now there. She's got a cane, you know, because she's been through some trauma. And she is wounded, you know, missing a finger, and holds it up. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. Previous scene before this, the doctor who is repairing Sherry waves goodbye. You know, like she's in the hospital and Ted Levine's asking her. He waves goodbye. He's missing his ring finger. So even the doctors of the town are part of the whole thing. And anyway, so Sherry turns into Robert Englund at the end.
Yeah, and like the thing that is said is like, I think we get voiceover from Pictureman on this. There's an old saying in Rikers Valley, beware of people with missing parts because the machine is with them or something. It's like, okay. So first of all, that's an old saying in Rikers Valley. It's just a thing people are saying.
A common thing.
This sort of underscores kind of, you know, the ableism that's going on in this film, specifically, I mean, most sort of egregiously with Robert Englund's character, where he's got all of these like prostheses and things, because the mangler has taken so much from him. And one of the things he keeps saying is, and the thing that is said over and over again in the film is that, you know, there's a piece of me in that machine and there's a piece of the machine in me. So there's this thing that it's doing where, you know, using a cane or having leg braces is a thing that makes you less human, right? Because you've got metal on you and that makes you more like the machine and you're giving up your flesh for the machine and so that's just, there's like this sort of like half-baked like industrial thing going on here, and it's sort of evoked also in the first scene at Mark's house where the cop like looks down and sees a water wheel, like just an old-fashioned idyllic water wheel, and then it flashes to a shot of the mangler's gears. So it's like, ah, there's like good technology and bad technology, right? What if technology but too much?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. No, yeah, there's I actually really associate this with like the 1980s horror boom, 1970s, 1980s horror boom. Like these really, I don't like using this word, but I think it's the most appropriate, like sophomoric ideas. Like, what if technology, but too much? Like, that's so insufficient to like have an idea. And I totally understand. Like, I also don't like this word. I don't like what, you know, what gets called like elevated horror, like A24 horror or whatever. I don't like these terminologies and things like that. But I do think that there's a really clear divide in the horror world between horror that is very content with like, what if technology, but too much, or like, you know, the kind of, easy inversions of like Wishmaster films or Leprechaun, where it's like, not quite. I mean, these movies all do turn into like kind of schlocky horror, but they don't kind of start out that way. They start out with these like nature culture divides. And then when they spiral into themselves, they get in these weird spots. But it does seem like if you're starting with this very basic idea that's not particularly good, when we keep iterating on it, we're not going to get anywhere better. And I do like that there is that we've had a wave of horror in over the past 10, 15 years that seems to be thinking things that are beyond just like, what if technology but too much? Because I think that ultimately really hurts this film in a broad sense. Is like, I think Tobe Hooper is, as a director, has a lot more going on, and, you know, not to bang the Texas Chainsaw Massacre drum too much, but like, that's a movie with a lot of ideas about the world, you know, and ideas about how the social kind of fits together in a broad sense. And if there's something to me that really is kind of a bummer about like the post Hellraiser 1 or like later Jason films or later Nightmare on Elm Streets or whatever, like as we get into franchisation of these film series, it's like, they don't have much thought going into them, or you can't see the thought on the screen. Mm-hmm. And that's just a bummer to me. Yeah. And I hate that we've like had to create this other fictional dichotomy of like smart horror and like, you know, dumb horror or whatever.
Yeah.
Like that also is not descriptive of the world to me either. But it does seem like the Mangler is part of a wave of horror that where the horizon line was not very far away from where we were. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see the A24ization of the Mangler.
Yes.
Like, and I think it's possible. I think you could do really, really cool stuff with just the skeleton of what's going on here that wouldn't just be like goofy. I think it could be really interesting and cool, really developed.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. And just one other thing I want to mention about this final scene where the cop comes back to the laundry and discovers the terrible truth of what has happened to Sherry. He has brought flowers for her.
Yes.
Again, this is a 16-year-old girl. Also, why would she be here if they just escaped from the laundry machine that tried to kill them? But he comes back the next day, like in his jean jacket and with his flowers for her. And then he sees her up there on the catwalks, you know, having sort of been possessed by Robert England or whatever. Still 16 years old, by the way. So this 16-year-old girl is now managing this laundry.
I don't know. So that's the weird thing about it. Is it could be the next day or it could be 4 years later.
I guess that's true. But Ted Levine, like, you know, he sees her up there and she like waves. She like, you know, raises her hand to wave hello. And very clearly you can see where they've scrubbed out her ring finger. So we know for sure that she's been possessed. And Ted Levine's response is kind of like Charlie Brown.
Oh, shucks. Yeah.
He's just like, oh, shucks. And he turns around and he throws the flowers into like a laundry bin and walks out.
Yeah, I don't know what the time. Like, you have to assume that there's longer time there. Apparently, they were really worried about the effect shot there. They like wrote that in. They're like, how are we going to do it? And the effects studio was like, don't you worry about it. Jurassic Park came out. We've got this bad boy solved.
We can make this woman's finger disappear for a shot.
And I'm pretty sure Brooks is like, yeah, they just said paint it blue and we'll take care of it. And they did.
Yeah.
Oh, well, so I like The Mangler. I thought that movie was, I thought it was cool. It is kind of weird to me now trying to reconstruct it that it's hard to reconstruct, which is strange.
I mean, as I said, there are kind of like three versions of this movie in one, right? There's like a version that is Sherry's story. There's a version that is John and Mark and their investigation. And then there's a version that is John and Picturemen and sort of their relationship in the investigation.
Yep. And all of those are like half done,
yes,
basically. But I think ultimately at the end of the day, like, it is a cool movie. I'm not mad that I watched it. I think it's legitimately entertaining and a pretty good horror film. You know, I don't think it's any worse than the vast majority of horror films made between 1980 and 1995.
Yeah.
When it came out.
And every scene at the laundry for about like maybe the first 75-80% of the movie, I just think rocks when it's in kind of its high like expressionist mode and England is just doing his thing. Like, I just think that whole thing rocks.
Yeah, I think it's haunted a little bit by being a Toby Hooper movie. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that really hurt it. And also, I mean, you know, it's in that kind of, it's closer to closer to a canon film than it is a Poltergeist, mm-hmm, right? Like,
mm-hmm, very much.
Like it in the kind of you know, circuit of films, it's closer to, as we've seen a bunch of these that we've done for the show already, it's closer to a De Laurentiis production. Mm-hmm. You know, it's made for way less money than you would make another Hollywood film, but bringing in good talent to make that movie, and I think that like the effects look good. I think that the direction is really good stylistically, all that kind of stuff. I think that what works about the movie really works. And I think you're right that, you know, if there's a real thing with it really hurts it the most, it's that it's a few projects kind of all sandwiched together that, you know, kind of hard to, the through line is hard to follow. Mm-hmm. And yeah, everyone's like so mad about the premise, and I think you're right. At the beginning of the episode, it's like, I've seen a lot of bad, you know, I've seen these movies about a guy that creates elaborate traps for people who have done a naughty thing in their life, and it's just about watching them get hurt.
Right, it's like, you didn't appreciate your life enough. Now I'm going to home alone you.
Yeah, and it's like, this, like, the mangler is inherently, in my mind, no worse than that. And certainly I had just as good a time as I did, or I had just as good a time watching this as I have several of those kinds of movies. So I think it's pretty cool, and I think it looks really good, and I think that this newest kind of transfer of it is really neat looking. Cinematography is really cool, and I would encourage people to check it out, even if you're a little bit curious.
Yeah, I recommend it as well. Take it from me, like the boy with fond memories of the Casket Factory. This is one spooky industrial place you want to check out.
Oh, next month, Michael, we are doing Creepshow.
Yeah, yeah, along with the comic book. George A. Romero's Creepshow.
I haven't seen Creepshow before, so I'm excited to check that out. I know it's kind of like near and dear, right? Like, people really like it.
Yeah, I think in terms of like Stephen King films, this one has some love for it. I think, you know, it's an anthology film. King himself is in it. It is his acting debut, or sort of his real acting debut, I guess. Weirdly enough, this is not the first time that Romero and King had collaborated, because King showed up as an extra in Romero's Knight Rider a couple of years before. But yeah, like, Stephen King himself will be in the movie, and it'll be interesting. It'll be very interesting, I think, because rarely do we have a book and a movie that we're doing that fit so closely together. So I think that'll make hopefully an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I think it will. I'm excited about it, and we'll dig right into it. Thanks so much for supporting us here on Patreon, helping us do this thing that we do. We really enjoy doing the show, and we can only do it because you help give us money to do it. As we said in the main episode for this month, we got a new merch store. The description, I'll have it, I have the line here, and it'll be in the newsletter for this month and all the other stuff. It'll be easy to find. But yeah, we got some shirts, or we got a couple shirts, and then a cool thing. You'll have info about it. Like a print. a thing. You know, the thing. But yeah, I don't want to belabor the point too much. Thanks so much for doing this. As I say, over time, we only grow because of word of mouth from you. So, if you could tell one person about the show that you would really like, tell one person who might really like the show about the show, then that would really help us out a whole lot, really improve our lives. Help us get to our big goal, where we're trying to get to $4,500 a month so that we can start a Homestuck podcast. And we are actually kind of on the way. We are closer than we've ever been before. And if you want to be responsible /
culpable.
Appreciated. Yeah, culpable. Great word. Then you can help us get there by just telling people about the show if you enjoy it. And then telling them that you like specifically these bonus episodes. So on social media, someone that you know, send them an email, that kind of thing. Michael, you want to take us out?
Do it for the world, folks. But also, remember why we're here. We're doing it for Steve.